Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med et af vores store forbilleder, en af vores sande inspiratorer, nemlig den amerikanske essayist, forfatter og aktivist Rebecca Solnit. Jeg ved godt, at vi har mange forbilleder og mange inspiratorer. Jeg gang på gang siger, at det er helt enestående, hvad de har bedrevet. Men det er også fordi Langsomme Samtaler handler om at knytte alle vores forskellige forbilleder og inspiratorer sammen i en stor fælles samtale, hvor vi trækker på hinandens indsigter, idéer, indfald, analyser, inspirationer, og på en eller anden måde knytter det an til en aktivisme, som vi ved vil skubbe til verden til sidst. Vores slogan er jo, sammen forandrer vi verden langsomt. Og Rebecca Solnit er en af dem, som har været med til at inspirere det slogan, for hun skrev for nogle år siden en helt fantastisk bog, der hedder Hope in the Dark, som handler om, hvordan alle store, væsentlige forandringer i verden er kommet uforudset. Vi havde ikke set det komme, da muren faldt i Østtyskland. Vi havde ikke set det komme, da kvinderne pludselig krævede deres ret. Vi havde ikke set det komme, at den amerikanske borgerrettighedsbevægelse blev så stor. Vi havde ikke set det komme, at arbejderbevægelsen pludselig skulle kræve stemmeret, medbestemmelse og økonomisk demokrati. Og grunden til, at vi ikke havde set det komme, det er, at dem, der har magten, altid er de synlige. Og dem, der ikke har magten, altid er usynlige, indtil de får den. Det er derfor, hun siger, at håbet er i mørket derude hos dem, som vi endnu ikke ser og endnu ikke har hørt fra. Og vi gør det, vi gør. Laver Dagbladet Information, laver Langsomme Samtaler, skriver vores artikler og bøger, holder vores foredrag, kommer rundt i forsamlingshusene, taler med hinanden i tillid til, at det nok skal nå ud til alle dem ude i mørket, der har brug for det. Og det er i meget høj grad Rebecca Solnit, der har inspireret den tro og den tillid. Hun er en stor amerikansk klimaaktivist. Hun er en meget, meget vigtig amerikansk feminist. Hun er en progressiv med en særlig stemme, som formår at sætte det æstetiske sammen med det politiske på en måde, der hverken bliver træls eller tung eller dogmatisk, men tværtimod bliver let og løfterig. Senest har vi her på Dagbladet Information haft den store fornøjelse at udgive hendes essaysamling Hvis Historie Er Det, som er en samling af tekster skrevet gennem de sidste 15-20 år, der handler om kvindekamp, klimakamp, aktivisme generelt. Og så er det en særskilt pointe hos Rebecca Solnit, at man skal værdsætte skønheden i tilværelsen. Man skal huske på roserne, planterne, dyrene, de store øjeblikke, den lykke, vi kæmper for. Og det siger hun, at venstrefløjen har været alt for dårlig til. Venstrefløjen har brokket sig, jamret, klaget og hisset sig op over alt det, der er helvede til. Og det er også rigtigt nok. Men der er også skønhed, glæde og lykke. Og det er jo det, vi kæmper for, og det, som Rebecca Solnit altid minder os om. Her følger min samtale med Rebecca Solnit.
I've been thinking a lot about how you work, because on the one hand, you're definitely an intellectual. You're writing essays, and they're very, very carefully drafted. You can see that you put a lot of effort into making the sentences just right. You make these public interventions. You write essays about what's going on in society. You write comments. And the intellectual is often understood as someone very singular, someone saying the truth to the masses in, you know, with Jean-Paul Sartre being the big role model. And you're not like that at all, because you always emphasize the collective part of what you're doing. You refer to what your friends are saying. You're an organizer. You're an activist. You go into the field. It seems to me that you combine what Hannah Arendt called vita activa and vita contemplativa. How do you see this balance?
I love being connected to Hannah Arendt. I'm reading a wonderful new book about her now by Lindsay Stonebridge. My subject matter wouldn't exist if I wasn't going out into the world to see how the world gets changed, what movements are doing, what new ideas are surfacing. I know there's much more rarefied in academic versions, the philosophers who only talk to other philosophers, the academics who don't really leave the university. But a lot of my subject is activism, social change, politics more broadly. And going out into the world gives me a chance to find out what other people are thinking, see change actually happen. I know I write a lot about things that I've only read about, 19th century anti-slavery movements, for example. But you, something happens when you witness these things. So, and then I would also say, I could get very isolated and very lost in my own theories of reality if I didn't actually get out of the house and hang out with other people from time to time. And maybe my greatest influence in life has been my brother David, who's been an activist since he was a teenager, which really means since, I'm only 2 years older than him. So, and he would draw me into whatever he was doing. And I have also found the communities of activists are often generous, brave, heroic at moments when other intellectuals can seem self-involved, focused on self-protection or self-enhancement. So people often look at hanging out with political activists, going to protests, being as I am now, part of four different climate groups, as, eating your broccoli. And I'm always saying, sometimes it's drinking your champagne. Sometimes these are wonderful people to be with. Sometimes it's really exciting to see ideas in action. Because in a sense, to wrap up this one, ideas only matter in their impact in many ways. And you see their impact, you see the way that an idea that begins as maybe the world should be different actually changes the world so that it is different. And that's many things, including really exciting to witness, to see. So I feel it, it's research, it's morally reinforcing, it's good company. And at some sense, I'm also hedging my bet because yes, I believe in, what writing can do in the world, but at some level, there's nothing like a blockade.
Wonderful. A big theme in your work is the difference between darkness and light, and that's not understood in terms of bad or good. It's not about that. It's also about being transitioning from being a nobody to being a somebody, to having a voice. You've written beautifully and very importantly about that. And you also reflect that now that you are a somebody and you have a voice and you're in the light, people are listening to what you're saying. You have a global audience, actually. With that power that comes with that position, there's also a certain blindness. There are things that people aren't telling you because they see you as someone in power. There are things that you aren't seeing. How do you deal with that balance?
I won't say that I'm grateful that I was supposed to be nobody when I was young, but young women are often assumed to be nobody. Nobody's going to listen to you. Nobody will believe you. What you think or feel doesn't matter. And there's a saying in English, nobody knows. And so often what that means is that all the people who know are considered to be nobody, people who don't matter, people who won't be listened to, people whose voices don't have consequence. And the world is divided up that way, but women are more nobody than men, people of color, immigrants, children, the elderly, the disabled, more so. I think if you're born into a high status position, it's very easy to forget that other people are having a very different experience. One of the most despicable kinds of human beings, who I think is also very common, is the person who treats the powerful and the powerless, the high status and the low status person differently. And so that essay of mine, Nobody Knows, is about going from being a very low status person who essentially had no voice to being an high status enough that secrets were being kept from me because in this case, a very powerful man was sexually harassing a very young woman while also trying to impress me. And if I had known what was going on, not only would I have done what the young woman there didn't do, which is probably to tell him, what a piece of shit he was and how disgusting he was, But he also saw me as part of his public life of making a good impression, whereas the young woman he was harassing and the few other young women who knew he was doing it, to him, were not part of that public life, were not people who mattered. So this is really about whatever however high your status may be or have become, to not forget people are maybe treating you the way you are because of your status and you're not seeing the whole picture. And the powerless often see what is hidden from the public, the official audience, the public audience, the man who treats the servants terribly and his colleagues well, the people who do things to children and pretend they're completely different people in front of adults and stuff. So I just felt that was, as part of my feminism, which is so much about writing about inequality of power and inequality of voice, a really important consideration.
I was grateful to read it because I think it comes with everyone. I'm an editor for this newspaper. There are things that you don't see because the sun always shines upwards, but not downwards. And that's not here within the organization only. It's in the outside world as well. And I think it's a very, very good point. There's a wonderful phrase in Whose Story Is This? Where you say, I'm old enough now to be a repository of the way things were before. This is a place from which you write quite often that I remember how things were. Moral progress have taken place. The thing about moral progress is you take it for granted when you internalize it. You think that's how things always were. And I think it's an important part of this book, and of course about not too late, as well, saying, well, we've actually come a long way. We're part of a history of progress. What we're doing matters, and I think we need that conscious, because if we didn't have a history of moral progress, it would be meaningless. On the other hand, there's also this sense among young people that we who are older, we talk about progress that were before their time. And they feel they're born into a world where strong men are leading again, where democracy is being dismantled. I'm dramatizing a little bit, but that's how they see it. And of course, first and foremost, that nature is collapsing around them. How do you see this dilemma between taking the experience of decline seriously among activists and young people going out there, and then insisting that progress have taken place?
Those two things are not incompatible. So much of my work is about addressing habits of mind, the frameworks in which people describe the world we're in, set their own expectations of what's possible and what's normal. One of the great fallacies, I think, is the all or nothing story, that if everything hasn't gotten better, then surely everything has gotten worse. The world is radically different than the world I was born into, and it is both radically better and radically worse. I think if you don't remember how much worse it was around race, gender, the denial of the very existence of indigenous people in the Americas, at homophobia, the mistreatment and marginalization of people with disabilities, etc., then you don't know how much it's changed for the better in those respects. If you don't know that there wasn't even a language to talk about the environment, hardly in the early 60s in English, until Rachel Carson in the US really changed that. Ideas that are now normal, like downwind, downstream, the life cycle of materials, compost, recycling, those were not really concepts in which people were looking at the material world around them. Endangered species, at the people were mostly not thinking about the consequences of the dumping chemicals in rivers, using pesticides, using toxic materials, and about the cumulative effect of the things we were doing. The environmental movement and now the climate movement, I think, has really created a revolution in consciousness. Obviously, the world could be in much better shape if we had done much more, but if you subtract the existence of the environmental movement, if you we had de not developed this consciousness, these regulations, these protections, the world would be profoundly worse than it is now. And so I think You can see both at once. You don't have to make the world all one way or all the other way. And some of what we're seeing right now is a reaction against progressive success. And Donald Trump himself was reacting against Barack Obama, a liberal black man, and tapping into a bunch of white rage that a black man had been elected. And then there's other feedback loops. And one thing I think that's terribly evil in my time, and I'm very embarrassed it, I live where it comes from, because I used to be proud of being from the San Francisco Bay Area. Now I'm essentially from Silicon Valley. And you look at some of those strongmen, Putin, Trump, Bolsonaro, all using social media and their capacity for inciting rage, spreading misinformation and hate, etc. Bolsonaro in Brazil, who did 4 years of, I think it was 4 years, 5 years of terrible destruction, was elected because of YouTube, owned by Google, about 20 miles or 15 miles from me here. So, the world has changed so much, and nothing that has happened means that there's any reason to give up, I believe. And again, the long view, I think, instills hope, confidence, and a sense of your own power. The short view does not. And in the long view, you see profound change for the better. In the long view, you also see how change works. And to use an American example, the short view is like, oh, the Supreme Court gave us marriage equality. The long view says the Supreme Court ratified a transformation in cultural norms that was achieved by countless queer people coming out to their families, their friends, their coworkers, at their neighbors, by changing the very idea of what was normal, acceptable, and mainstream. So it wasn't nine people on the Supreme Court. It was millions of people in homes, workplaces, schools, writing, speaking, organizing, who made that change. You look at a big piece of climate legislation that passes at the very end, there will be powerful politicians. But at the beginning, there will be climate activists who may be, in remote parts of the world, maybe young, maybe indigenous, maybe people of color, maybe in the global south. And so you need that long arc to understand change. Martin Luther King famously said, "The arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice." And you can't see it bend at all, whether it bends towards justice or injustice, if you don't have a longer perspective. So a lot of what I've tried to do in writing about politics is just to remind people we don't understand the world by looking at what happened yesterday or in the last 3 weeks or 3 months. We need to understand the last 3 decades or sometimes the last 3 centuries to really understand the nature of change, what's been achieved, what's been lost, what remains possible. Me too is one of those things also that gets treated as though it didn't do anything. And of course, Harvey Weinstein will spend the rest of his life in jail, but it's one of those things where the indirect consequences might be most important. It's not the men we send to jail, it's the men who no longer believe they could get away with that, and even more deeply than that, I don't think you can punish your way out of injustice. You have to create a world in which it doesn't occur to people they have the right to harm, violate, and degrade other human beings, and they don't have the desire for it. And that has to do with how children are raised by their families, by their schools, by the stories they're told, by the world around them. And that, I think, is happening imperfectly with a huge backlash, but is happening.
When Me Too movement started here in Denmark, at least, and it came in two waves. The first one was very short, and then you had another one that was a couple of months, and it was really culturally changing. And I think all of those who criticize woke, they've internalized it today, and they're grateful for having internalized it. This is really a sweeping progress. But what I think we have seen, this is what I spoke to Virginie Despentes, the French writer, about, is that a lot of the women who stepped forward, they've suffered immensely after that. They've been exposed to a lot of digital hate, and they were kind of celebrated as power feminists or the new warriors stepping forward. And then what Virginie Despentes said, which I thought was very interesting, is that we celebrate the accuser, but we offer no institution for making peace or compromise after that. So you have a lot of women stepping forward and being exposed to a lot of hate, and they catapult some change, but they also suffer immensely. And I'm curious how you see this problem.
Yeah, and that goes back to Silicon Valley, which is run by white men who don't understand inequality in any meaningful way and have tolerated campaigns of hate and harassment on their platforms. Because I if we're talking about digital hate, we're probably talking about exactly. Twitter and Facebook and some of the, you know, Reddit, some of the related things. And, you know, I think the women who have stepped up have been tremendously brave. I've also heard from women who decided not to because it wasn't, the price was too high. This, you know, if you're an actress or something, it's not what you want to be known for all your life. And then women who stepped forward when they felt the time was right. The wife of the governor of California, Jennifer Siebel Newsom, stepped forward to testify against Harvey Weinstein as somebody who had been raped by him. You know, so there is a huge price to pay, but it has changed the world profoundly for the better. And you see that all the time. I had a friend who investigated sexual crimes on at a university campus here in California. And the reason women came forward is so that to protect other people's, you know, and this often happens around sexual abuse. The person doesn't want to speak up for themselves. They want to speak up to stop this from happening to anybody else. And, but I think that the impact has to be measured. I don't know about Denmark, but, you know, laws changed, laws were enforced that hadn't been enforced. People felt much more confident about the ability to speak up and be believed, because so many of the misogynist stories that treated women as inherently unreliable and men as inherently reliable, for example, the idea that women lie all the time about rape, as though, you know, criminals don't lie about committing crimes ever, really fell down. And, you know, a lot of these cases happen in ways that I think were really informative and educational. And for various reasons, Taylor Swift's case has come up for me recently. She did one of those meet and greet things where the celebrity goes and poses with the people, in this case at a radio station several years ago, and one of the radio station guys grabbed her ass, and she told his employers who fired him, and he sued her. And she just demonstrated to all her young fans, like, I am not responsible for his actions, and I'm not responsible for the consequences of his actions. Because all our lives we were told, like, you know, and literally there have been many cases where judges would tell rape victims, you're ruining a promising young man's life by testifying against him, not he's ruining a promising young woman's life by assaulting her in such a horrible way. And so you see all these cases that just happened in a way that had never happened before, that became changes in the fundamental frameworks of these stories. But again, I think, you know, the criminal justice system is not the best way to change the world. I think it's great if these rapists go to prison, if somebody who grabbed Taylor Swift's ass loses his job and becomes most famous for the rest of his life as somebody who grabbed Taylor Swift's ass. But I truly think we can't punish our way into a better world. We have to transform the culture into one where it's no longer considered an enhancement to your masculinity and entitlement, you know, an erotic thing to do these horrific and grotesque things. And so, you know, I want deeper change, and I think it is happening in a lot of ways. And, things that were considered normal, like domestic violence, are a lot less normalized than they used to be. And, you know, you go back to the movies of the 60s, and there's just a tremendous amount of rape, harassment, denigration, violence against women all being played as though it's really fun, because the movies were made entirely from a male point of view. And, One of the interesting experiences I have had a lot in recent years is going back to something I thought I enjoyed, like Purple Rain with Prince, and seeing some kind of malice that I didn't see the first time around. And with Purple Rain, there's so much misogyny, and it was fascinating to me to think, who was I at 21 when I was much more like the woman who's being so badly treated in the movie, and yet it didn't bother me. Was it that I identified with the man that I knew I lived in a world where objecting to it would do nothing, and all I could do was, try and pretend that everything was fine because there was no alternative. But the world has changed profoundly, and changed profoundly by Me Too. And while individual women have paid a price, I think women as a whole, and really men as a whole, because I don't think it improves men's lives to get away with rape. So I'm grateful to them that they paid to make the world better. And the reward is that the world is actually better. And because of them, the real story, and this is true for environmental things, the real story will be all the men who don't do these things, just as the real story for the climate movement is all the coal-fired plants that won't be opened, all the fossil fuel that won't be extracted. For the environmental movement, it's always been the dams that weren't built, the trees that weren't cut down, the species that didn't go extinct, the chemicals that weren't poured into the river, the kids who didn't get asthma. So we also have to tell stories that show what didn't happen as a result of what did happen.
To a certain extent, I see Joe Biden as a kind of proof of that, because you have this centrist Democrat who's been going through some really transformation. It was the first part of the administration at the time to support marriage equality, and he's done this very progressive environmental legislation, and he's taken on some fights with big business that I'm not sure he gets enough credit for, that he's embodied some progressive ideas. This book, Whose Story Is This, came out, I think, in 2019. And I remember the time because we were in America and we were watching the Elizabeth Warren campaign gearing up. And there was this sense that, that the social movements of a decades, they were coming into politics now, that Occupy Wall Street would finally be part of politics through the Bernie Sanders campaign. Elizabeth Warren was bringing a lot of very progressive ideas. It was a couple of years after the Me Too movement had its culmination. It had been growing for a long time. So in 2019, 2020, we were very optimistic, of course, most of all because of the Green movement. And we had the European parliamentary election in 2019 that were very green. It's going to be black this time. At the time, I felt, well, social movements have been revitalized. People are paying attention to them. And, even Joe Biden cannot rule without taking in the Bernie Sanders people. Now, 3, 4 years later, there's a sense of disillusion here in Europe, at least, that we won on a rhetoric level the climate battle, but they're not doing it. We're seeing some of the strategies are now being used by anti-climate protesters. Now they're saying that we want this passionately. We've been robbed. And I think a lot of people here are discussing how should we reinvent our strategies? How should we reinvent ourselves for this different moment? How do you see this moment for social movements?
It's really interesting what you bring up because a lot of these ideas did succeed because of pressure from activists coming out of Occupy Wall Street. Biden has canceled a lot of student loan debt. But much more than that, the very idea that this financial arrangement, this exploitation of college students for profit is legitimate, has really been undermined. A number of other economic ideas that are more progressive have become normalized, as has women's rights in ways they weren't before. And we lost, thanks to the Trump Supreme Court, abortion rights on the federal level. But even in Alabama, maybe the most conservative state in the country, a Democrat just won election campaigning on abortion rights, reproductive rights, etc. So a lot of times people are so eager to say something failed if, The enemy doesn't capitulate and wave a white flag and say, you were right and we're going home and you'll never hear from us again. And people seem to imagine victory is perfect, permanent, and comprehensive. And anything less is not victory, which means that they're missing, you know, what we've really achieved. You know, me too, likewise, since you mentioned it, I can speak to this country best. There's been a lot of high profile cases. There's still big high profile cases in the newspaper with Sean Diddy Combs right now. But more than that, there's been legislation and rule changes. But there's also just been a change of consciousness. In that essay, Nobody Knows, I talk about being sexually harassed in the workplace before even Anita Hill had spoken up. And knowing that nobody really cared, I had no rights, that there was no way to make objections to that, there now are, partly because I think more women are newspaper editors, judges, police investigators, etc., or men who've been in, you know, who've been transformed in what who they're willing to listen to, how they understand the world. And, you know, the people who are the victims of these things are being heard and being protected in completely different ways. As for Joe Biden, he doesn't seem to be an inflexible ideologue. He seems very responsive, and certainly he has been to climate, which is a subject the Obama administration was not particularly focused on. And I think the climate movement made him make climate a big part of his platform and all the other Democratic candidates. And you can really trace a straight line back to this story of longer timeframes from the founding of the Sunrise Movement in 2018, their creation of the Green New Deal, which of course doesn't pass, but gets introduced into Congress and does a lot of very powerful things. Simply because it's so ambitious, it sets very different goals than people were setting. All my life, people were suggesting that it was jobs versus the environment, but suddenly you have the idea that doing what the environment needs is a great jobs bill, that it creates jobs and good jobs. And it becomes a template for Biden's platform and then for his massive piece of legislation, which is so complex and has so many kinds of impact that most people don't know anything about it. And this is one of the really sad things right now. Most people don't know what's happened. A lot of angry young people know the two crummy things the Biden administration approved and don't know the 10,000 other things that they've done. And this kind of low information opinions abound worldwide. And they're also a problem in that an administration doesn't do two things. It does, you know, 20,000 things. And people forming an opinion based on one or two are often really missing the real picture. So you can see the whole trajectory from the founding of the Sunrise Movement, though, to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is doing huge things in the United States, but has also inspired other countries around the world to accelerate their programs, increase their funding, focus on some of the things the Green New Deal does, like jobs in domestic manufacturing, and speed up the energy transition. So, you know, I always want to calculate the indirect and unquantifiable consequences. And another fallacy I'm always coming up against this idea, you either, you know, you demand something today, if you don't win tomorrow, you lost. You demand something today, if you don't get exactly what you ordered, as though life is just a restaurant, then somehow you failed. And often it comes out in different forms. It comes out slowly, it comes out unpredictably. It has positive benefits that you didn't calculate on. For example, the Standing Rock pipeline protests in 2016 did not actually stop the pipeline, but they educated non-Native people about Indigenous rights, land rights, and beliefs around the sacredness of water in a big way. They created these incredibly powerful connection between people in many Indigenous nations and the biggest Indigenous gathering maybe ever of all those nations, and healed old wounds. The veterans of the U.S. Army came and got down on their knees and apologized for what the US military had been doing for centuries to Native people. So much happened. And then Standing Rock inspired Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to run for Congress. And then it hooks back to she becomes the person who champions the Green New Deal, the person who introduces it in Congress. And she's had a tremendous positive effect. So I always want a more complex story, a story that's not simple, short term, you know, told in absolutist terms of entirely good or entirely evil, black and white. And that's so much of what I'm trying to do as a writer, is to give us these more complex narratives that let us appreciate what's really happening and what's really possible. There's a saying attributed to Albert Einstein I have been using for 30 something years. Everything should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. And you get a lot of versions of politics change, the nature of power, the nature of society and societies that are simpler than the reality, simpler than, you know, they should be. And we always lose something in the process. And part of my job is to try and bring back what's been lost in those oversimplified, reductive stories.
One of the very difficult issues for the climate movement, here's something we discuss a lot, is actually part of a triumph. It's on a rhetorical level. It doesn't make sense to say believe in science anymore, because most people do. We can say that a lot of people don't believe in politics. They don't believe that we can solve the problem. But that's a different story. And I think most, at least Donald Trump is a really spectacular exception, but most even right-wing democratic leaders here in Europe recognize that climate change is real and that it's happening. So all these old signs, we don't have a planet B and climate change is real, they're not helpful anymore. And what is difficult now is that it becomes so complex that it's all about they say they do it, but are they really greenwashing? We want to see how are they doing with the transformation of our energy grid. The moral sloganeering, wake up, it's real, has kind of won here. But how do we keep these grand enterprises accountable? How do we take to the street and demand something that's very, very technical about solar energy, for instance? And it's hard to translate the old ethos of public demonstration with the moment that where we are now, because so much is decided, and it's really, really interesting, which you also see from your book, Not Too Late. There are so many different entries. How do you see this challenge of fighting for a sustainable world is also becoming a technological battle?
It always has been. And we do have a great new slogan, delay is the new denial, and greenwashing, et cetera. And many years ago, I heard a scientist on the radio. I wish I could figure out who it was on what program. But he said, if you wanted to create a problem uniquely difficult for people to understand and respond to, climate change, which is the result of centuries of behavior causing many kinds of consequences all over the globe, many of them only perceptible through scientific measurements, things happening in the upper atmosphere, things happening in other parts of the world, things happening slowly, you know, and a problem whose solutions were not one thing, but many, then climate change is it. It's an incredibly complex problem to get people involved in. I actually think, and this is the kind of victory that's hard to celebrate because it's so intangible, but the fact that the great majority of people, when asked in polls in most parts of the world, don't just believe climate change is real, they take it very seriously. They want to see action. They want to see change. They want to see government money spent. They're willing to make changes themselves. That's a huge victory for the climate movement, because the climate movement really, much more than the media, you know, made people sit up and pay attention. I do agree we need the next thing, and I don't know what the next thing will be. And nobody foresaw Greta Thunberg appear. And when she first started protesting, I'm sure, well, of course, very few people noticed when she first started protesting. Then it's very easy to say, what's one 14 or 15 year old gonna do? And what she's gonna do ultimately is create movements with millions of people on almost every continent on Earth, to speak truth to power at Davos and the UN, inspire a lot of other people. You know, I didn't know that the sunrise movement was coming, and often feels like, well, when we have summer thunderstorms in New Mexico, where I try and spend time every summer, there's this real hush. You know, the air becomes very still, and then the storm breaks and the air is very turbulent. And I was just talking to Thelma, my co-editor for Not Too Late, and we feel that we're in one of those moments. It does feel like things, there's a kind of stasis, and it's not necessarily a problem that the existing old movements can solve. It's the people who will come next who will solve it. And so I know there will be a next thing. I don't know where, who, what form it will take. And meanwhile, I will just keep doing the climate work I keep doing as a board member of two climate groups, with, you know, the co-director of the Not Too Late project, somebody who tries to speak about climate change every time I'm in public, etc. So yeah, so it is dismaying, because in a way, if we didn't have the solutions, it would make sense that we weren't doing what we needed to do, because, you know, it's like, if there are no lifeboats to get into, we understand why you don't get into the lifeboats. But the fact that we know exactly what to do, that it actually could work out beautifully, because renewables are actually cheaper as well as infinitely cleaner than fossil fuel, which is both political poison, as Europe has learned from Putin, and we all know from Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, as well as literal poison. The fact that we have the solutions, and somehow the minority of people who either are the fossil fuel industry or have vested interests in it or are otherwise protecting the status quo are preventing this transition from happening is really dismaying. But I feel that that just means we need to build a climate movement more powerful than the fossil fuel industry and its allies. And the fossil fuel industry is not on solid ground. Things are very shaky for them right now, even though they've made a lot of money since Putin invaded. You know, the coal industry has mostly collapsed in the US. And again, the long-term picture is where it gets so exciting. You look at the UK that ran almost entirely on coal, you know, 75 years ago, and the fact that they are completely off coal for all intents and purposes. They are done with coal. Nobody could have imagined that in 1955, you know, when people were still dying from coal smog in London. And I don't know what your formative years were like, but when I first visited Europe as a teenager, I remember the coal blackened cities like Glasgow, and later in my early 20s, Dublin. And, you know, things have changed pretty profoundly. The sad thing is, if there was no climate crisis, renewables are the best way to make electricity for every reason, not just cost. And electrifying everything makes total sense. That the world will just be better if we're not pumping methane into our homes, we're not burning, you know, extracting and burning this stuff. And so it's odd, I think, because we think we need to do it for the climate crisis. We're not looking at, this is not a sacrifice, this is not austerity, this is abundance and improvement. What we live in now, as I've written about more recently, is the austerity and the sacrifice, because fossil fuel is so poisonous and destructive, but we've normalized it. So I also feel like we need to change the language around how good things could be if we just do what the climate needs us to do.
I want to hear near the end, turn to a book that a very, very good book you wrote, I think it came out in 2009, called Paradise Built in Hell, when you went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And there's a very beautiful part of the book where you return to Dr. Martin Luther King and his words about the beloved community. And I feel that he had a spiritual dimension. A lot of what came out in the 60s came out of the churches, meaning also that it transcended social class. It had a broader appeal than that. And I often feel today that progressives lack the spiritual dimension that the churches had back in the 60s, that we lack the capacity to build a beloved community that transcends our own circles, that are more broadly appealing. And I think in order to take the next step from the anger of Greta Thunberg, from the real anger of Greta Thunberg, Camille Etienne, Luisa Neubauer, we must meet our adversaries and build common ground with them. We must build something, new places together. You know, people being angry on each side, the right will be winning that battle. So we must have people coming together. And I was thinking about that when rereading Paradise, Build and Help, because I think that's what you find in some of Martin Luther King's celebration of the beloved community. How do you see this question of how to create a beloved community today, large scale, small scale, and the spiritual dimension?
Martin Luther King was not particularly popular in the United States in his day. People were outraged, indignant, even people who weren't outright racist and opposed to what he was working towards thought the civil rights movement was too radical and should be polite and, you know, ask nicely for things, which you never get when you only ask nicely. The beloved community, I think, for him was like-minded people, people who shared a dream and a vision. So he wasn't trying to make nice with, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. And I think that the spirituality question is interesting. One of the remarkable things that's happened, as I perceive it over the last 30 years, is the rise in visibility, power, voice, and leadership of indigenous people across the Americas, from, you know, Bolivia and Chile to Canada. And they approach all environmental problems or all environmental issues as spiritual issues. They have brought tremendous spirituality to the climate movement, the environmental movement. There's been indigenous-led movements like Idle No More that came out of Canada in 2012, but they've led a lot of the pipeline struggles. And I think, you know, and there have been these incredible alliances in the climate movement. The opposition to the KXL pipeline to pump dirty tar sands crude to refineries in the southern U.S. brought together farmers, you know, in fairly conservative places like Nebraska, indigenous people, young climate activists, and traditional environmentalists. So we have been, I think there are beloved communities being built, and that very idea of evaluation of community has been really important. I think all the white people who came out for Black Lives Matter, you know, were committed to trying to bridge a racial divide. And so I see that, yes, we absolutely could use more, but another one of the fallacies I try and write against is the idea that if we don't have all of it perfectly, then we have none of it. And so, like, yes, we could definitely use more. Another thing that I think has been very influential in this country and in the progressive and activist world is Buddhist ideas. And when Thich Nhat Hanh died, I guess two years ago in February, the outpouring of response to his death reminded me it's not just people who are officially Buddhist who are really influenced by Buddhist ideas in the West, that these ideas about compassion, being present, mindfulness, non-separation, non-duality, have really permeated the culture. So I think that spirituality is present. There's, in many ways, in progressive movements, there's an old left that treated all religion as though it was conservative Christianity. And of course, liberal Christianity continues to exist in this country and elsewhere. And we now have a Pope who in many ways is very progressive, including around climate. So I think that more would be great, but what is there is wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. That's a beautiful place to end. Thank you for your time and for your work and for what you continue to give us.
Thank you. Take care.
You
bye-bye.
Too.
Det var min samtale med Rebecca Solnit, og den bog, som er udgangspunktet for samtalen, hedder Hvis historie er det. Det er en fantastisk god indgang til hendes værk, fordi der er mange små tekster, der hver især giver et lysglimt af inspiration og virkelyst og eftertanke. Og hvis man har lyst til at anskaffe sig den, og det kan jeg kun på det kraftigste anbefale, så kan man gå ind på butik.information.dk, køb den derinde, og hvis man så bliver abonnent, så kan man endda få den med en klækkelig rabat. Så det man kan gøre inde på butik.information.dk, det er, at man kan faktisk skrive sig op til en måneds gratis, og samtidig få rabat på Rebecca Solnits fantastiske bog, Hvis historie er det. Jeg vil bare advare mod, hvis man gør det, så bliver det stærkt vanedannende. Så får man en kammerat for livet, nemlig Dagbladet Information. Og man får en læsekammerat tilsvarende for livet, nemlig Rebecca Solnit. Prøv det, jeg er helt sikker på, at I ikke kommer til at fortryde det. Den her samtale var produceret, redigeret af sig sammen af vores helt vidunderlige ven og hjælper, Albert Kuhlmann. I næste uge, der skal det også handle om klima. Men der går vi fra gaden til magten. Der går vi fra den essayistiske aktivist til formanden for IPCC, FN's klimapanel, Jim Ski, som jeg har mødt til en samtale i Den Sorte Diamant i København, hvor vi kommer hele vejen rundt om den store grønne omstilling. Vi ser meget hårdt ned i afgrunden, men vi kigger også lidt op på himlen. Tak for, at I er med hele vejen denne gang og næste gang igen. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg.